So, as Kamal and Aga mentioned, we've been following this series. It's based on this book. I just thought I'd bring it along to show you. It's called Sailing the Worldly Winds by Vajragupta. And, yeah, as Kamal and Aga were saying, it's just I've personally found it really brilliant going back to this material, actually. It's the third time I've read this book. It's really, really practical and immediate. But it's also, it goes all the way to kind of wisdom. Sort of connects ethics with wisdom, so it's really, really fantastic. The teaching, although Vajragupta is a modern Buddhist, the teaching goes all the way back to the Buddha. So I just thought I'd mention that as by way of introduction. He taught this. It appears in the Pali Canon in two places, the Parinirvana Sutta and the Lokavipatti Sutta. And the translation worldly winds comes from the word loka dharma, which literally translates as worldly conditions. So I've just got all of my Pali out of the way. it's a sort of teaching about the kind of ups and downs of life, basically, how life kind of blows us about. That's sort of what the teaching is trying to get to. So I wanted to just talk in brief about the worldly winds in general, and then I'll get on to talking about praise and blame. So the worldly winds, they come in four pairs. There's eight of them. And so you've got gain and loss, fame and infamy, pleasure and pain, praise and blame. And a common characteristic of each pair is that we're attracted to one of the pair, and we want to push the other pair away. So we're attracted to gain, we want gain, we want things in our life. We don't want to lose things, we push that away. Same with pleasure and pain. We want pleasure, we don't want pain. And just to say, I can find all of these in my experience. They're all there. Yeah. I'm attracted to material things. I don't like losing things. I want to be noticed, I don't want to be unpopular. I seek pleasure, I don't want pain, etc. And I think that the main point with this teaching is if we attach our happiness to these worldly winds, then we're going to experience disappointment, basically, because we can't predict when the winds are going to blow one way or the other way, basically. So if you don't remember anything else from the talk, that's what you need to remember. And I'm going to go into some examples from my own experience looking at praise and blame. And some of these might seem quite kind of small and sort of insignificant. But I wanted to just make the point that actually the sort of small things in life are really, really significant, basically. It's often the small, niggly things that kind of catches out. And often sort of bigger things in life sort of bring out the best in us. And the last session 2 weeks ago, Kamal and Aga mentioned karma, this teaching of karma. And the more we do actions, small actions in life, the more we will sort of do those actions in the future. The image for this that the Buddha gave was creating kind of grooves. So actually, habitual karma, which is the doing of small things over and over again, is actually very, very sort of strong karma. It's sort of one of the strongest streams of karma. Yep. So, yeah, tonight I'm going to talk specifically about praise and blame. And, joked at the end of the last session that praise and blame is like my favourite pair of worldly winds. But I wasn't joking, actually. Experienced a lot of, sort of praise and blame. Actually experienced quite a lot of unsatisfactoriness in my life in regard to these two worldly winds. I just suggest explore all of them. You'll probably find you've got a favourite too. So I work as an architect, and praise doesn't come easily in architecture, in the architectural world. When you're studying, you've got these pin-ups. You pin up your drawing at the end of the term, and they're called crits. They've got a really horrible word. I used to think that it meant sort of criticism, but actually it does mean that. It means critique. But often what you get is kind of criticism. Yeah. And I used to have quite low self-esteem, actually, and I was really, really blown about by what I thought other people thought of me. And, my self-esteem, I sort of propped up my self-esteem through my career. So I'd often find through my sort of career that if things were going well, my sort of self-esteem was sort of... was propped up, and if I attracted kind of blame or criticism, my self-esteem, I started kind of hitting kind of low points and things like that. So I used to sort of measure my sense of self-worth through what other people thought of me, basically. And I just remembered a really sort of really quick example to give. This is actually when I'd started practicing Buddhism. And it was a summer a few years ago in, it's 2014, and I just started work at my current job. And I remember it was a really hot summer that year, and this is before I was vegan, so I really fancied going out for an ice cream. And there was just this internal narrative of I really fancy ice cream, it's really hot, but what will my boss think of me? What will my boss think of me? And because I kind of clocked this, I decided to not fall into worrying about what my boss felt. It took quite some time to do this, probably about half an hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I stood up and decided to tell the office. I stood up and said, right, I'm going outside for an ice cream. And my boss stood up and he said, that's a great idea, I'll have a Magnum. And it's just really, really interesting that I'd created this kind of narrative of what I thought my boss thought of me, which is completely untrue, basically. Yeah. So I've been blown about by praise and blame throughout my sort of career, and I still am to an extent, but I've really worked on that through applying teachings like the one found in the book. So I'm going to unpack this teaching in the book a little bit, and then I'll go on to some ways of working with it that I'll suggest. Yeah. So just to explain sort of praise and blame. So praise in itself is actually really, really positive. So an example of praise is rejoicing in merits. It's really, really positive to be rejoiced in by Kamalanaga just then. But it wasn't just positive for me, it's positive for Kamalanaga to do that too. And actually everyone listening, you know, it has a kind of positive effect on the sort of atmosphere of the room, basically. And I've introduced people, and it's a really lovely thing to do, actually. It's very, very positive, kind of giving praise. And also with praise as well, actually, it's really important if you are praised. I think it's really, really important to accept that praise. I used to find it really difficult to accept praise, actually. But what you're doing is you're blocking someone's sort of positivity, actually, if you do that. Yeah. So praise is positive, both giving and receiving. It has a positive effect on our mind. So what is praise as a worldly wind? Well, it's what I said earlier. Seeking praise is the that's the worldly wind. And I remembered a recent example of this, which you might remember, Kamalanaga, when we got back from ordination, we went up to Padmaloka, and it was the welcome back. Two of our friends were giving talks, and Arta Priya, our public preceptor, was talking as well. And I just noticed, as everyone was speaking, I was kind of just looking out for someone to just mention my name. And it was really, really interesting, because what actually happened was I sort of disengaged a bit from the sort of speakers. And then no one mentioned me. And it was really just ever so slightly painful. I kind of clocked it as it was happening. But it's actually just like really painful because of being sort of affected by the worldly wind itself, but also feeling sort of detached from my friends who were, you know, that prepared these talks. Yeah, so that's an example of sort of praise as a kind of worldly wind. And I think, yeah, without sort of awareness, you know, I think I'd sort of clocked it. I was able to work with it in the moment, but without awareness, that can start to fall into sort of negative mental states. That sort of thing, you can kind of fall into sort of resentment or ill will or something like that. Yeah. So on to blame. Blame itself is negative. Blame is an expression of negative emotion, basically ill will or resentment. So if you blame someone for something happening, that's what you're doing. You're expressing negative emotion. And also, I think with blame, you're shifting responsibility. I think it's a really, really important area, actually. Often you sort of see children sort of saying, "Oh no, it wasn't me. It was him." You know. And I think actually not doing that, I think, is really, really grown up. Sort of when you sort of take responsibility for something you've done and you don't blame someone else, it's really, really attractive, actually. It's a really, really sort of grown-up thing to do. I feel quite grown up when I sort of manage to do that. And when you've got blame kind of coming the other way, you just can't sort of avoid it sometimes, you know. Sometimes we might be blamed for something we've not done, for example. And when that happens, I think how we sort of respond to that is really, really important. If we sort of fall into blaming the other way, that's just negative emotion. It kind of can really affect us sort of negatively. Yeah. And a bit like praise, like blame is a worldly wind. Just trying to avoid blame is that's the worldly wind. That's when we sort of really run into sort of trouble. And I've got an example from my working life. It was in my previous job, and I was sent an email that was quite accusatory, and I ended up in a situation where I was sort of being blamed for something that I felt wasn't very sort of fair. But my boss was also sort of blaming me the other way, so I can't really go into details. But it was one of those situations where no matter what I did, someone would have been unhappy. It's actually really painful, because all I ended up doing was I just got really evasive with both of those people. And basically those two relationships both broke down. It was really, really sort of quite a painful situation that I sort of ended up in because of the way that I sort of responded, basically. Yeah. I mean, eventually I actually got kind of made redundant from that job because my sort of, relationship with my sort of employers, had kind of broken down, really. Yeah, it was a really huge shift in my life, actually. Yeah. Which ended up being really, really positive, as it happens. So with praise and blame, the main point is that we just can't avoid them. You know, they're there in the world. They blow us around. How we respond is the key. And in the book, there's a really great example of a retreat leader who, at the end of the retreat, was given a note by someone. And one of the people on the retreat, and she put it into her pocket, and then someone else came up and gave another note, put it in the other pocket. And after the retreat ended, she took one note out, and it said, "I wanted to thank you for the retreat. My highlight was seeing you bowing to the shrine. That really inspired me. I really, really wanted to kind of thank you for doing that. It really made my weekend." So the retreat leader was obviously quite pleased with that. And then taking the other note out of the pocket, said, "Well, thank you for the retreat, but I'm sorry to report that I had a really terrible weekend. Every time we came to the shrine room, I saw you bowing. And that really spoiled the retreat for me. I thought Buddhism was free of all that sort of rubbish, you know." I think it's just a really great example to bring in, actually, because it shows, you know, even with the same action, it's possible to get praise and blame. You know, we can't avoid praise and blame. Yeah. So how can we overcome the worldly winds? How can we overcome praise and blame? So to do this, we actually need to change our whole perspective on life by changing. And to do that, we need to change the way we relate to our experience, basically. Yeah. So I'll tell you how to do that now. Easy as that. So in the Loka Vipati Sutta, the Buddha makes this distinction between two types of people. One, on one hand, is the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. So that's someone who hasn't contacted the Dharma. And then on the other hand, you've got the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones. So firstly, an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person relates to the worldly winds in the way that I described earlier, craving one of the pair and pushing away the other one of the pair. So yeah, with praise and blame, we crave praise and we have aversion to blame. And Buddhism tells us that craving and aversion, along with ignorance, they're the three poisons. They're the source of all of our unsatisfactoriness in life, basically. So they're the root of our unhappiness in the world. So that's the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. The well-instructed disciple, on the other hand, is not troubled by the worldly winds. And that's because they've got a dharmic perspective. They have reflected on the impermanence of the worldly winds, and they've got a bigger perspective. Yeah, so in the sutta, the well-instructed disciple, it says, sees the worldly winds as inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. So impermanence. So, yeah, so one way of sort of talking about this is that the well-instructed disciple, they're more in contact with how things are, or more in contact with the nature of reality. And one way of talking about how things are is the Buddha's teaching of conditionality, which is also known as dependent arising. The Sanskrit word is pratityasamutpada. And this is the kind of central, the sort of deepest insight of the Buddha, basically, the deepest insight of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. And I'll read out one. This is, what I'm going to read out now is one of the most famous verses of text in Buddhism, which is said to describe this sort of deep and profound insight. This describes conditionality. So this being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So one way of interpreting this is all conditioned things exist in dependence on conditions. And that might sound a bit sort of scientific or formulaic, and it might sound a bit like cause and effect. But it's not quite what's being got at. Pratityasamutpada is much more mysterious. It's pointing towards a kind of web of interconnected conditions out of which things arise and pass away. That's a kind of true reflection of the nature of reality. A really good image for this is a rainbow. So if you think about a rainbow, what are the conditions that bring a rainbow into being? You've got moisture in the air, it's been raining, and you've got sunlight. And you have to be in a particular position in order to be able to see the rainbow. Rainbow arises. And it's probably not difficult to imagine if one of those conditions isn't in place that the rainbow ceases, basically. So that's an image for conditionality. Yeah. So with things like rainbows, it's really easy to kind of see impermanence, basically, because they're quite sort of fleeting. But conditionality also applies to us. We're just like the rainbow, but this is much harder to see. In fact, our ego is quite sort of threatened by reality, basically. We like to fix things down in the world, and that's why we kind of hold on to things. And things that threaten our ego, we push them away. So that's how conditionality kind of relates to the worldly winds. Yeah. But anyway, for the purpose of this talk, a little bit on conditionality, but for the purposes of this talk, I think the analogy of wind is just really, really good. I think that's why the worldly winds, it's just such a great sort of analogy. Yeah, just relying on the worldly winds for our happiness is just unreliable. It's just not gonna work. Basically, the winds are impermanent. But if we can see the world essentially as impermanent, if we can get closer to that, we're closer to reality, and we can then therefore be less sort of attached. We sort of don't crave things quite as much. We don't push things away quite as much. And from that comes a sort of the experience of liberation or freedom. Yeah, and that's the sort of perspective of the well instructed disciple. Yeah. So what I want to do now is to describe a practice that Kamala Naga will introduce us to after the talk. This is called reaction practice. And what this does, it starts to kind of train us into what is our sort of underlying responses of kind of craving and aversion, basically. Yeah. And you can use this with, you can use this with any reaction, basically. But we're going to apply this to worldly winds of praise and blame. Yeah. And what this is sort of based on is feeling into what's known as Vedana. So Vedana, you don't need to remember the terminology, but Vedana is the sort of feeling tone of our experience. It's the sort of building blocks from where our sort of emotions come from. So with Vedana, you've got pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And this reaction practice we'll start looking for Vedana in our experience, basically, yeah. And it's probably not so difficult to see where the craving and aversion that I mentioned before comes from. It comes from sort of this sort of feeling tone experience. Yeah. So we'll do that following on from the talk. And the basic structure of reaction practice, which we'll do a bit later, is that what we want to do is sort of when we catch the worldly wind that we're sort of reacting to, we just need to kind of acknowledge it's there in our experience, and then we tune into that sort of that response I talked about, Vedana. And the key for doing that is in the body, and then we'll see if we can move to a more sort of creative response to that reaction, basically. But I just wanted to give an example from my experience when I've used this practice recently, and it might just give you a sense of what a creative response might be. And then I'll just go on to say some sort of concluding words before we sort of try out for ourselves. So this example, it relates to praise and blame. And Vajragupta in the book, he suggests with praise and blame, one of the things we can look out for. He calls these sort of Dharma doors. So it's a sort of the opportunity that exists within that sort of worldly wind to move towards something more creative. And for praise and blame, it's truthfulness, basically. We want to kind of see truth, reflect on sort of truthfulness. So the example was when I got back to work after the ordination course in the summer, I found out there was a problem on one of the projects I'd been working on. So it was on site, and there was a sort of issue that I thought we might get sued for, basically quite a sort of serious issue that they had to do some rectification works on the building that was already being built. And I just fell into kind of self-blame. I sort of immediately fell into my usual sort of response to that sort of situation. But I caught it, and I realised I was reacting. And I'd remembered on the ordination course this reaction practice. So what I did was I worked with it in the moment and felt into what that experience really sort of felt like in my body, the kind of discomfort of that, not sort of pushing it away. And I used that sort of reflection on impermanence I mentioned. I sort of realised that if I put awareness to it, I would be able to move through it. I sort of had a confidence that I'd be able to work with what was going on. And what was really interesting was that I sort of started to reflect on what was true in that particular situation. I sort of asked myself, well, is it true that I'm to blame, basically? And what I sort of clocked was that although I'd been involved, actually, I hadn't directly worked on the on that sort of aspect of the project. And my sort of experience then changed. What actually happened was I then started falling into blame the other way. It's like, oh, it's their fault. And then I had to stay with that reaction and sort of feel into that. And but eventually what sort of emerged was it was like a kind of a bigger perspective, basically. The sort of blaming tendency just moved. It just sort of dissipated eventually. And I was able actually then to kind of realise, well, I probably could have done that in the situation. I could have maybe supported my colleague, but also maybe I could have been better supported as well. And then I realised, well, actually, probably the situation isn't quite as bad as I'd first thought, and I had actually advised the client at the time of the issue, so it probably wasn't as bad as I'd kind of as I'd sort of reacted to in the first place. Yeah, and I think that for me, well, the example, it just sort of illustrates how I'd sort of managed to move from this sort of place of anxiety from the kind of worldly wind of blame. Just to a sort of more truthful and clear account of what had happened. I'd moved from a place where my ego was feeling really threatened to a place where I felt more open and more compassionate towards my colleagues, more compassionate towards myself. And I just had a more clear account of what had actually happened and how I could act sort of differently next time. So I sort of learned from the experience. Yeah. Yes, I hope maybe that's helpful for when we do the sort of the reflection. So I'll just summarise now and draw to a close. I was really struck actually at the last session that Kamala Naga did. At the very end, he asked us these questions from the book, and I was left thinking about them over the weekend. Actually, he asked us to reflect on these three questions. What is most important in your life? Do you really believe in that? And how can we live by that? And I just thought that was really, really, really great sort of way to end the last time's session. Kamala Naga was referring to values, and I just think it's really, really apt with these teachings. And one way of looking at the worldly winds is that they're expressing the kind of values of the world, you know. They've got a kind of narrow me narrative. And they also express the values of materialism and individualism, basically, out there, which I could give a whole other talk on, but, you know, they're the kind of source of suffering in the world, basically. Yeah, and I don't want to live my life based on those values anymore. Yeah. I don't want to live my life based on what other people think of me anymore. In fact, it's not even that, is it? It's like what I think other people think of me. I don't live by that anymore, because that just doesn't make any sense at all, does it? And becoming an order member, getting ordained, I've committed my life to religious values or spiritual values, if you prefer that language. Values of kindness, generosity, truthfulness, mindfulness. At ordination, I took up what's called the Dharmacharya, the Dharma life. And one way of interpreting that is, Dharma meaning truth, basically. He who courses in the truth is one translation of Dharmachari. So that my title is Dharmachari Shobhanaga, he who courses in the truth. That they're expressed through the 10 precepts. They're expressed in my Dharma name, and they're expressed in my Yidam, Green Tara, who's on the shrine tonight. I wanted to read out. I wanted to end with the 4 ordination vows that I took up at my ordination. So I'll read those, and that'll be the end of the end of the talk. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination.